Hi, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here in Adelaide to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season two of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating or most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we ask the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to Dr. Natalie Harkin, an Arunga woman who's a renowned writer and poet based in Adelaide. She's currently a senior research fellow at Flinders University, where she's working on decolonising state archives and using archival poetic methods to research Aboriginal women's histories in South Australia. Her latest book, Archival Poetics, was published in 2019 by Vagabond Press and won the John Bray Poetry Award at this year's Adelaide Festival. Welcome to Archive Fever, Natalie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Natalie, when did you first contract archive fever? I mean, is it an affliction that dates just to your work on archival poetics, or does it date back much longer than that?
So Archival Poetics was published last year, but it is a book that's come out of my PhD thesis, which I started back in 2011. And that thesis was a response, really, what I felt like I had to do, this embodied response to my family's archives that I've been collecting with family for many, many years. So probably from the early 1990s, I started going to state Aboriginal records and various archival repositories, just looking for bits of information, and not necessarily to find my Aboriginal family, but to, I guess, piece together some of the missing narratives, and also just to make sense of our lives and how fractured and disconnected we were culturally, both from country, from language, from community, etc. You know, knowing we're a part of a bigger Aboriginal family and community, but yeah, pretty fractured in lots of ways. So trying to make sense of that, I guess. So the archives were one source, and obviously our oral histories and our embodied archive and our lived memory is the other archive, which is really critical and important. But once I started accessing those records, it was just like, yeah, it was very difficult to stop following that paper trail, which takes you on a massive journey. It's very unanticipated. You don't know where it's going to take you.
Mm. And one of the reasons we were so keen to talk to you about archival poetics is that it really explicitly engages with this idea of archive fever that is the focus of this podcast. You know, you quote Derrida in your work, and on repeated occasions you refer to what you call the archive fever paradox, writing, "Archive fever paradox, my blood, it pumps where hearts have stopped." Can you sort of maybe tell us a bit about what you mean by this kind of archive fever paradox and how archive fever manifested for you?
I was just getting little bits of recorded information from Aboriginal records, and then my cousin and I, at the request of my nana, went to LinkUp, and at that stage LinkUp had a lot more resources and funding to do some research for people who would come and present and say, okay, well, you know, we know who our family are, so I wasn't searching for family, but on behalf of my nana, she wants to know why she was taken from her community at Point Pierce and from her family and community who really loved her, and then experienced this life being fostered and placed into two very brutal institutions in South Australia, children's homes, when she had a family that clearly loved her. Mm. So going to LinkUp and then thinking we'll get a bit of information about my great-grandmother, Grace Chester, but what we ended up getting was this incredible file on my nana, which she had no idea about. And it was quite a traumatising experience. Really, the entire document was incredibly sensitive. Like, there was nothing in there that was not sensitive or had this very affective dimension to it. my Nana tore out some of the pages that referred specifically to her being naughty, which was a label that then, you know, met with severe punishment. That was actually her agency. She ran away a lot. She was punished for that. She did a lot of things that were just normal things that kids would do, but she was punished as an Aboriginal child. And I think what these archives also show us was that there is incredible resilience and strength that's not depicted, but it's unfortunately it's depicted as naughty or misbehaviour or whatever. But that wasn't the only stuff that was that she was upset about. But I think that's where the fever really struck me, was the potency. It was always potent, these documents. I've not received ever one document. Just the fact that we're recorded to me is, you know, such an obscene, in the way that we're recorded by the state simply for being Aboriginal. And that's from the point of first contact. There was an obsession of surveilling Aboriginal people in a way that was very oppressive and controlling and containing, not ever from the perspective of Aboriginal people. So having these documents in their entirety in a collection in the way that were collected for us in this ring-bound file was just really mind-blowing. It just sat with me for a really long time, and Nana put it at the bottom of her wardrobe, and we all knew about this archive. We'd made copies for family, etc. But it was something that we didn't really talk about a lot after that moment, but it was always with me. These archives were always with me, and then we just kept going on to different trails and getting more and more records. And for me, I think I just was creating this mountain. I'd talk about it in the way that I was creating the very thing I was trying to interrogate, which was the archive and an archive and just collecting so much information. I felt like I was drowning in it. So for me, the only way to, I guess, get out of that was to weave with the records and write poetry. So that poetic response did feel like a very healing and cathartic way of dealing with this data and this information that is always with us. It's never not with you. So how you deal with it, we have to go into those, I think, those really dark, traumatic aspects of ourselves and our history. And that's not just our family history, but our shared history and our local communities and our national history. We have to go into those really dark, traumatic places in order to transform creatively out from them, to create something different and honouring. And for me, weaving a basket, a Ngarrindjeri basket, particularly I wanted to honour my Nana's letters and my great-grandmother's letters that were in these archives and take them out of that really traumatic kind of archive box that held them in a very particular way, and to weave them into something more honouring and beautiful. And as I've written about, a basket can hold many things. And I wanted that to be a new story, a new narrative of her life or their lives, but also so that, you know, when our kids, grandkids and future generations can go back to these archives and look for traces of family, that they'll see a different kind of archive, the way we want to represent them. So put the spotlight on the state, but also really honour that resilience of our families.
Natalie, one of the things that strikes me listening to you talk is about that container that the archives come in, you know, the archive box, and then your agency in taking control of that and fashioning it into something that is more meaningful and speaks to you. And that strikes me as really interesting, because so many people who we've talked to on Archive Fever have explained that part of their fever, part of their obsession with the archives, is a kind of reverence for the container that the archive comes in. We've waxed lyrical about our love of stationery here on Archive Fever, you know, the envelopes, the manila folders, the fastenings, the bindings that hold these documents, and we kind of approach them in an almost kind of church-like manner and often wear white gloves. And to hear you talk about your Nana actually ripping pieces of the archive and you...
They were photocopied papers, by the way.
Well, I'll stop myself breaking into a sweat then. Although I love that. I mean, because I mean, what you're saying is that the archive, the process of documenting Aboriginal lives was an act of violence. And to hear about your Nana, you know, ripping it and you talking about, you know, weaving these archives back. What your work does is a kind of taking control of the archive. And yet part of the paradox, it sounds like to me, is that there is what Derrida did describe as a kind of homecoming that archival research also gives you. You are being returned to the origin in some kind of way. How does an Indigenous woman from South Australia and an old white French theorist dude, how do those two sensibilities come together?
The paradox for me is that these are the records that are revered, and they're the records that I love to hate. Like, I love them and I hate them. I do get excited by the archive box. I wrote about how violent these spaces are. Of course they are very violent, and the way they were gathered, the way they were contained, and what they represent in terms of the official narrative, the truth of the state that still people refer back to as the truth. So the paradox for me is that they are the records that I love to hate. Derrida's archive fever, and also his work on hauntology, is really important, I think, as a basis. It's not the be-all and end-all. I refer to a lot of other people who engage with archive theory. But yeah, that origin, that real feverish desire to go back to the origin, I think is really what gripped me the most. And that's what spoke to me with that particular quote of Derrida's about going back to the origin. It's really important. That is what struck me. And that it was a fever. Like, I get so physically transformed. My partner goes, oh, here she goes again. She's got struck by, you know, the archive fever. And I get these records sent to me every now and then. I applied for records for our state Aboriginal Women's Domestic Service history. So I'm getting a lot of records coming through to me from state records about these domestic service files. And every time I'd get an email, I'd just have to stop everything and just go straight to it. And it's partly the origin, but it's also not. And I think that's what Derrida's talking about as well, that it is going back to the origin of something, but it never is the actual beginning. You can never find the actual beginning. There is no finding it. That's the fever will take you in that place, but you'll never find necessarily what you're looking for, because there are multiple beginnings. And certainly, I guess, from an Aboriginal perspective, coming in it from a different way, that there are multiple archives. There's archives of, you know, our lived body, our lived experience, this blood memory that comes through us. But it's also the archive of the landscape, the archive of the forced movement and surveillance. And, you know, we were moved all around the state. So
you talk about this gathering, this process of finding and gathering and drawing the archives back in from the places where they've ended up, where this documentation has ended up. Do you think there should be some kind of separate repository where those archives can end up, a kind of keeping place, in the way that we are now talking about returning Aboriginal remains? Should there be a separate keeping place for archives that particularly relate to Indigenous people in Australia?
I think that's for communities to really determine how and what archives are kept where, and that's been very absent in South Australia. All those conversations have been happening for a very long time in different places. There was a archives conference last year that, what was it called again, Designing the Archives.
We did not. We're not that nerdy. We don't go to archives conferences.
That would be a whole different level.
Oh, I think you're very nerdy, and I think this is very cool. You would have loved it. It would have blown your mind. Like, it blew my mind. I couldn't get over it. It was such a critical interrogation of archives and archiving practices and processes. And for the first time, there was the International Council on Archives with a Society of Archivists and various other organisations that had come together for this particular conference. But there was a very strong First Nations voice and presence. And there was a summit at Tandanya Cultural Institute here, which is, and it's now called the Tandanya Declaration, on decolonising archives and what that means for Aboriginal people. So these questions of access and control and repositories and keeping places was something that recurred. And as part of decolonising and taking records from those colonial archive boxes and putting them back into keeping places, and there's so many keeping places, but it's really for communities to determine how they do that. I've got so many archives that I'm keeping. I'm trying to work out now what to do with them, but digitising and making them accessible to family and extended community is definitely on my radar. There's an amazing project that's happening in Western Australia led by Elfie Shiasaki on the Noongar Letters Project, repatriating letters that are kept on the colonial archive back to descendants of those letter writers, a bit like wanting to do something else with my Nana and my great-grandmother's letters, there are so many letters and petitions and this really strong advocacy from our community who resisted that control and containment and legislation that oppressed them. So these letters are vitally important to get back to community now and to descendants of those letter writers to say, well, they fought for us. They were very strong in resisting what was happening. This was not a passive colonial process. They were very active in resisting what was happening to their families and to them. And those letters show our strength, resilience, and the refusal of Aboriginal people to say, okay, we'll take that, because they didn't, and they fought really hard. And I think those kinds of letters are really important to counter the narrative that Aboriginal people were destitute and neglected and charged as such on the record by the various courts that said they were destitute, neglect, to then the impetus for them being removed from family. And certainly that's what the letters in my family's files show, that there was a deep love and there was very deep care and concern and fighting for the children that were taken away. So that kind of counters that entirely. Mm. So this letters project, going back to the community in the ways that they want, is really the most important thing. So it's, yeah, different repositories, different places, depending on what people want, I think.
Natalie, it strikes me in a sense that in creating Archival Poetics, you've kind of created a repository of your own, you know, an archive of your own. I mean that in the sense that the book, you know, it's not really even a book. It's sort of a three-dimensional object that, you know, there's three little books that come within brown cardboard, which sort of, to my mind at least, resembles an archive box.
Yep.
And the, you know, individual books are filled with poetry, but also with facsimiles from the archive, with photographs, with quotations from other scholars, in such a way that I think it is really hard to describe Archival Poetics just as a book. And indeed, one reviewer has said, quote, "Archival Reviewer is predominantly text-based, but I'd not call it a book. Like most First Nations knowledge, it does not fit easily into Western categories. To me, it felt more like a dream or a deep yarn or a walk through an exhibition, possibly all at the same time." And I was really fascinated by that idea of archival poetics resisting Western categories of knowledge. Does that kind of characterisation ring true to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm really glad that reviewer felt like it wasn't, I didn't want it to be a straight narrative of poetry, or this is just describing my fever, or literally just poetry responding to an archive. Mm. For me, I wanted the reader or the viewer to really experience that in some way, so that it's an object that has an added layer of this affective dimension to it. I'm interested in what you can do with words, not just writing them onto the page, but projecting them onto sites that are really important and important to speak back to, like the South Australian Museum, for instance. So projecting words, putting them onto material. So for the Whitewash Brainwash exhibition that I did, I put some poetry onto sheets and hung some linen, as well as tea towels, and getting some primary quotes from various magazines, including the Australian Women's Mirror, early 1920s. The depictions of Aboriginal women in those magazines is absolutely appalling, and yet it's sort of purported to be, you know, this feminist magazine or this really important, and it was an important magazine for women back in the early 1920s, but, you know, how they represented Aboriginal women was just appalling, and that's just that critique of feminism that still needs to be teased out a lot, I think, in the feminist movement about Aboriginal women.
White feminism in Australia.
Yes.
Has a lot of issues going on.
Shout out to our La Trobe colleague, Liz Connor, who's written a book called Skin Deep about the representations of Aboriginal women throughout the colonial period.
Yeah, critical work. Yeah, definitely shout out to Liz Connor and many others too who are critiquing feminism and those kinds of representations and depictions of Aboriginal people. Mm. It's really important. So how we speak back to that as well is just another dimension as well. And the basket has been woven, it's been hung in windows, it's been filmed by Ali Gamilia Baker, who is one of my colleagues and friends who I work with the Unbound Collective, so a group of Aboriginal women. And our work is looking at that nexus between this kind of research that we do, academic research and incorporating theory and our research for the academy, I guess, but that nexus of what creative arts can do, what spaces can open up that are those invisible spaces that we write and create and work into that otherwise wouldn't have existed. And I think that poetry, film, performance and the work that we do as a collective incorporates archives in that really creative way, which is really important to all of us because we all hold these stories in our hearts and in our bodies and our minds, and we're speaking back to those colonial narratives of our histories.
Natalie, you've gone through those multiple ways in which our history and stories can be manifest and represented, the various mediums that can be used. What about ways of knowing our history? You mentioned earlier that oral traditions obviously are incredibly important to any idea of an Indigenous archive, and particularly to the process of truth-telling that this nation has to go through if we're going to be truly reconciled and in line with the Uluru Statement. How can we weave those oral history traditions through a traditional colonial archive, or do they stand in complete contradistinction?
We need all of it. And I think part of going into the colonial archive is to reveal what's in that archive box and put the spotlight back on the state to say, well, this is our shared history. We have to bring out those really brutal, violent and traumatising aspects of those histories and bring it out to the fore so that non-Aboriginal people can see that this is actually their history too. That's part of it, is bringing it out so that we can have this really critical conversation, which I still think hasn't happened in this country enough. And so many people have talked about that and write about that, and that's what a lot of our creative responses are too, is to bring out our voices in our way. It's really important to counter some of the ways that we've been represented and still are represented. I think those oral histories have always been there, and it's about if you have a platform to always use that. So for me, poetry is a way of bringing in some of those stories that would otherwise have been hidden, repressed, not represented, either via the archive or also just bringing them out from our own family histories.
It seems to me poetry kind of returns the words into the oral tradition. It takes them off the paper and returns them back into the storytelling medium.
Yeah, Aboriginal people have always been storytellers, you know, and I think we do that in so many different ways, through film, through performance art, through visual arts, poetry, literature, and it's just feels like a natural way to actually be able to process our own stories and our own histories and representations through those colonial narratives of us to transform them into something else which fits comfortably with us. But for me, it's always also with that very deep rupturing, decolonising intent to do something else, to try and make the reader or the viewer complicit in that vision for social transformation. So that once you read something, you can't unread it. You know, now you know it, so what are you going to do with it? And there's a responsibility in that, I think. But yeah, I mean, a lot of our stories in our own families were just, I guess, were severed. So I don't have my language. We have smatterings of bits of language that my nana remembered. In fact, when we go back to Point Pierce, she remembered a lot more language, which was wonderful to see her be able to speak bits of language. But it's always just bits and pieces. You know, they weren't allowed to speak their language. They were forced not to. There was a lot of movement in our family as well. So whilst, you know, I'm saying I'm an Urunga woman, it's where my nana was born and she spent all of her childhood there. Our family identifies with that. But we also were forcibly moved from the West Coast and were in Panindi Mission, and then were moved into Raukan, what was known as Point Maclay Mission, and then forcibly moved to Point Pierce. So, and that's a very typical story in South Australia. That's something that there's a lot of movement. The mission history in here in South Australia, like right across the country, was incredibly brutal and successful in removing people from their traditional country. So we've got connections and family connections, you know, right across the state, really. But I guess a lot of our Chester family are buried at Point Pierce. We're still connected with Point Pierce. It's where I went mostly with my nana to visit all those sites that she remembered growing up in, you know, where she'd picnic, where she'd play, where she'd go to church, where she went to school, the beaches that she fished from, and just remembering some beautiful stories that she would tell while being on country was really important. That's our story. We've got an assimilation story. So whilst I don't have my language, or, you know, I don't have so many other stories and I don't live on country like many Aboriginal people, that assimilating story is really what has shaped me and my family. And really the archive is one key to unlocking what actually happened and how violent and oppressive it was, but also how strong and resilient our family were as well. So you get those dual voices of one of oppression and one of incredible resilience and refusal as well to comply with the state.
Natalie, in Archival Poetics, you know, you write really vividly about the kind of grip of archive fever and how it sort of felt suffocating and overwhelming. But you also include this really powerful Archival Poetics manifesto about sort of speaking back to the archive. Would you be willing to read this manifesto to us?
So in these three little books that are in that little archive slip that you talked about, the brown cardboard, there are a series of memory lessons. So this is book two, which is Haunting, Archival Poetics 2, Haunting, and it's memory lesson 7, The Manifesto. Lean in close. Take this offering as a slow, situated unfolding. Bear witness to the work of mourning, to those unofficial narratives of history that oppress, suppress voices of loved ones that are rarely, if ever, represented as their own. Follow ghosts and paper trails. Bear witness to buried histories that manifest seething fantasy norms and fixed imaginings maintained as truth in the present. Disrupt it all, through and beyond the colonial archive, with rupturing intent. Feed your desire to return to the origin as restless gathering, feverish hoarding. Honour what you conjure and recognise this as everyone's story. Surveillance file notes, letters, correspondence files, inspector reports, genealogies and photos, data cards, artifacts, specimens, remains. Soak up the blood. Don't let the weight of it kill you. Find new ways to negotiate loss imbued with effective aesthetic concerns for justice. It will come to you in uncanny moments and anticipated ways, where blood memory, haunting, and the potency of place collide. Expose state violence. Make visible the humanity of those trapped and lost, now complicit in their vision of refusal to be silent, silenced. You will recognise them as your own. Seek company of others who refuse to accept a culture of amnesia, who refuse to once again be left out of history. This is archive reckoning, through recognition, transformation, action. A re-memory collision, a fight-flight guide response, an embodied literary intervention to the ongoing project of colonialism and all its attempts to smooth dying pillows. Towards something else, gentle and restorative and just. They will take you back there with them. They will host you on new beginnings that never end. Don't stay still for long, for their vision is urgent and our descendants need you. Get to work, repatriate love, write decolonial poetry, forever mourn and weave your way out.
You mention in the manifesto this is an ongoing literary intervention. Can you tell us about the next stage of your literary intervention?
I'm just in the final year of a three-year project working on our Aboriginal domestic service history of South Australia. I don't think there's one Aboriginal family that I know in South Australia that doesn't have a domestic story, but it's not part of the larger narrative of history. It's not part of our labour movement's history. And if it is, they might tip their hat to this part of domestic service, but it's not ever written up as a significant form of labour. So domestic service, and that's mostly women, but you know, there's also indentured and unpaid labour of men, you know, in our history as well. But I'm now working with community, particularly women, descendants of domestic servants or domestic servant elders themselves who have this history of indentured labour, forced labour, or labour that was paid but controlled by the state, by the Children's Welfare Department or by being wards of the state by virtue of being just Aboriginal. And looking at these interrelated policies, I guess, what these archives are showing us is those very clearly the connection between the Aborigines Protection Board and the Children's Welfare Board and how they really dovetailed and worked together to target young girls for removal for then domestic service training. And that was a key assimilating measure for girls in South Australia. yeah, just getting those stories on the record, really, in ways that Aboriginal women want them to. So I'm not telling them how to tell their stories. It's a way of getting these stories on the record in creative ways that they would like. So whether it be through film or poetry, through oral histories, through the linen that I was referring to before with Whitewash Brainwash exhibition. Yeah, so that's pretty much where I'm at the moment. Mm.
Mm. Natalie, we're going to have to wrap it up, but if we can ask you one quick question that we ask everybody at the end of Archive Fever. Do you have a dirty little archive secret?
You know what? I've done a lot of critique of the South Australian Museum and particularly Norman Tyndale and those Board of Anthropological Research expeditions that went right across Australia, and including my family and community. And seeing those records in the museum, they're quite harrowing, you know, some of those data cards and the kind of data that they took on our families. But God, he was such a poetic writer. He was so, I've read his diaries and, you know, Tyndale, and I'd go, oh God, I love the way you write.
But I hate you as a person.
But yeah, such that really kind of poetic observations of country. And so I guess that's my dirty little secret. Despite what was happening and the intention of gathering all that data on Aboriginal people, there was also this seemed like quite a very deep aesthetic, beautiful observations of country as well, and love for people that he was taking information from.
Thank you, Natalie. It's been a wonderful interview.
Thank you to Natalie for coming into Archives Anonymous to chat with us today. To learn more about Natalie's work, you can buy a copy of Archival Poetics or check out her Flinders University profile.
So until next time, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith. This episode was recorded at Podbooth Studios on Kaurna land in Adelaide and produced on Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. Kaurna and Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com. And if you're new to our little nerd cult here at Archive Fever, you can catch up on all the episodes and plus get a bunch of nerdy little links and photos on our website, archivefeverpod.com.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. Coming up on our next episode.
You're thinking, well, it still happens, right? It still happens to people. And it is horrifying that we keep telling these stories. You know, these stories keep being told and this stuff still happens.